Please be advised this podcast contains descriptions of graphic violence and it's not appropriate for children. Amanda Howard is known around the traps as a serial killer whisperer. On any given day, she could receive mail on prison-issued stationery from one of Australia's most feared men, an internationally hated baby killer, or one of America's seemingly limitless numbers of death row inmates. This is Australian True Crime. Come with us as we explore how people become killers, how people become victims, and what happens next. It was a high school English teacher who first suggested that Amanda should go deep in her pursuit of the truth if she wanted to be a professional writer. I doubt the teacher meant for young Amanda to start looking for pen pals among some of the world's most prolific murderers, but that's just what she did. And over the years since, she's become a very successful author of both true crime and crime fiction. I met up with Amanda in Sydney recently and was amazed at how much we had in common, although I don't know why, because we true crime fans really are a certain kind of person, as I'm sure you'll agree.
I lost my husband to suicide 6 months ago, but we're open and honest about it, aren't we? I did a big Studio 10 segment on male suicide at 5 weeks.
Wow.
So I just had
Do you know Robin from Brisbane, Robin Bailey? No. Have you ever spoken to her? She's a radio announcer and she does a lot for Mamma Mia, and her husband suicided. Well, I just wondered because she's written a lot of articles about it, and she went back on air, I can't remember, maybe 6 weeks later, and yeah, she said it was cathartic and
oh, absolutely. I mean, you don't understand how horrifying that is, and you think about your own journey and you think about, you know, I felt I've been there, and you think that no one cares and you think that no one loves you, and then you're the other side of that story, and you think my husband was like my be all and end all, like my family. We are so close knit. We don't go out. We don't do social things. It's us.
Yeah.
And it's like my world was just torn apart.
I read the most incredible thing not long ago, and I thought that encapsulates it for me, is I want to be dead today, but tomorrow I won't.
That's my whole thing.
Yeah.
You know, we had no history, no warning, no nothing.
Yeah.
I was trying to ring him that afternoon to say, where are you? Let's go out for tea. It was last over term, all of that sort of thing. And it was just, I can't find you. I end up ringing his work and saying, have you seen him? They said, no, he went at lunchtime and said he won't be back.
Yeah.
That was his last words ever. I won't be back.
Wow.
Because they sort of said, I'll see you after lunch. And his words were, I won't be back. So
the pressure of whatever, it was just overwhelming. But
we had the perfect life. We were blessed. My Facebook is this amazing fairy tale life.
Yeah.
We were both so busy. Our children are amazing. And then I come home and I open the garage door and find him.
So did you ever get any sort of idea as to what was going
Still
on with
not.
Him?
I mean, it's 8 months this week.
Is mental illness? Is it depression? Is it
nothing. He had nothing.
Wow.
So he had a tough childhood.
Okay.
But we had been together for 24 years.
Yeah.
So I would think that I thought the 24 years would band-aid over the 18 years beforehand, but
no, it's amazing how that stuff haunts people.
And that's what I've learned. I mean, with a lot of the talking I've done and the people I've spoken to this age, the men seem to just break. They seem to have that moment at around 44, 45 that they go, I know this is where I should be, but I'm still not happy.
Wow,
because of all of that background, all of that horrible stuff that went on, it seems to just fester to the surface and they don't share, they don't talk.
Can I ask, was it sexual assault?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
The reason I ask is because I did a bit with the Ballarat survivors of sexual assault and only about 2 years ago, and that was my first sort of exposure really, like to actually talking to people at this level about it. And yes, that was a very common situation there.
And it's just this age.
Yeah.
And my sister's actually a mental health nurse and she goes, he ticks every single box
for health, for good health,
no, for taking his life. She goes,
wow,
we all should have seen it, but there was nothing to see.
No.
That's what they do.
Mm.
There is nothing. As I said, he was driving his prized possession car. It was an Audi A5. It's what he always wanted. He had it. High paying job. Loved his work.
Mm-hmm.
We traveled a lot. I was going really well. I mean, I'm still going pretty well, but we've had a couple of hiccups and there is bad days.
Mm.
But we have them, like our children are just our lives. But we just had that afternoon and it just, everything just went screeched to a stop.
Oh man.
So, yeah.
Yeah, it just destroys people. Yeah.
So that's like my last image of my husband.
Finding him.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So my son saw him too because I just started screaming.
Yeah.
So my neighbour stood there and watched us. That's the most horrifying part. I have that image as well of them staring at us.
Well, I guess they didn't know what to do.
They could see, but no, they're just horrible people.
Oh, okay.
They're really horrible, but anyway.
Wow.
I just thought I'd add that in.
Yeah, no, thanks for sharing that. That's amazing. Obviously, yeah, you've made the decision to be open about it because the secrecy and the shame that it used to carry would just then infect everybody.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And, you know...
And he has nothing to be ashamed of.
No. He was amazing and he'd come so far, and even just the week before he died, I had said to him, babe, we've made it. It's now about fulfilling the bank accounts. Like everything is sort of what's coming in is more than what's going out.
Yeah.
You know, the kids are doing really well. Our son had just started uni. Kira was in her last year of school in year six, you know, and it's like, let's do this.
I'm so sorry to hear that.
And it's just, so now it's just me and my two beautiful children.
I suppose the obvious question then is, has it changed your work at all? Just in terms of now knowing what it's like to lose someone very suddenly from your life without any lead up, without any signs or signals. Has it changed your work when you're looking at serial killers and their victims and their victims' families?
It's changed everything, but it's been a bit of a journey. I've written a book on hangings.
Okay.
So I'm one of the leading experts in the world on hangings.
Wow. Before your husband?
Before. Like when the police come into my house that night, I become a suspect because right there on my desk is a book with a noose.
Oh,
on the front
wow.
cover. So that's a bit, you become disgusted. I felt, should I be doing this?
Mm.
I understand a lot more about the victims' families and all of that. I've just gone through my own horrific tragedy and how do I put all these pieces back together? And it was actually quite horrifying. But then I realised almost at the same second, I need to talk. I need to speak about this. I'm a writer. I write about it a lot. And I've learned that my grief, I understand the grief of others. Everyone's grief is different. I can't say that what happened to my husband who chose this death isn't as bad as, you know, someone who's lost their daughter to a horrific rape or something like that. It's very, very different. But it makes me understand to a deeper level of wanting to have that closure and wanting to understand why we're at this point. So to know about how, you know, your daughter has just walked down the street and she's now dead.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I come home and open my garage and he's now dead.
Mm.
And it's that suddenness of not being able to say goodbye and not being able to ever reconcile that. And I think that gives me a deeper understanding. As I said, I can never understand the grief of a brutal
I don't mean to
like
compare
that.
Them that way, no. But you certainly now have the experience in losing someone suddenly who's not supposed to be dead, who's young and vital and not, you know, and also then in putting your life back together. And it's so interesting talking to victims' families, isn't it? Because the way people cope with tragedy is such an individual thing, isn't it? Some people say, actually, it gave me my purpose in life. I never felt like I had purpose, but now this is it, either finding justice for that person or whatever, you know. Other people retreat, other people drink themselves to death, other people... It's such a personal thing, this aftermath.
It is, and it's actually to a point when Steve was actually dying, I was talking to a girl about her family. Her aunt, as a child, was abducted in Adelaide, and I was talking to her about helping with that case. And it's just so weird that has actually now sort of enveloped into this larger quest that
that looking, one specific case has.
Yes. So wow. I'm now talking to other people of the cases. I've had death threats because I'm looking into these cases now. A lot of people don't want me to talk about the Adelaide children,
mm-hmm.
but I don't care mm-hmm. because I know that it's about bringing these children home, even if it is 40, 50, 60 years, you know, Beaumonts, Joanne Ratcliffe and mm-hmm. Kirsty Gordon, as well as the boys that were taken by the family. There is so many of them, and there's a lot of talk of pedophile groups and everything that's going on about around there, that this has become sort of, I can't fix me, so what else can I fix?
Yeah.
Because I come from a family of problem solvers, and that's what we do. We make things better. I can't make me better. I can't make my children better. We can survive as best as we can. But there is other people out there that have no answers at all. You know, I have those little bits of my husband's life, just those tiny threads that I pull together, and it doesn't make a cloth, but there's enough there that I know that if that's all I will get, that's okay. But there's people out there that don't even have a single thread.
Mm.
And I think that we need to give them something so that they actually have something to hold on to. So as I said, I've had death threats about looking at these cases, and I've had people tell me to back off and some weird and wonderful things that have happened. And I won't say which case that it's happening of, but it's given me a bit more purpose and drive that I don't want to be lost, and I find that if I can find something else, that loss will go. You know, it may never, and I may never solve anything, and I may never get the answers that they need, but as you say, it becomes a goal and a passion to actually look at these other sorts of cases. Mm.
And it feels like the working is what actually brings you comfort. You're a worker.
Oh my goodness, I work so many jobs.
Yeah. I'm a bit the same. I'm not so much anymore, actually. I've gotten terribly lazy lately, but I used to be definitely comforted by just working really hard.
Oh, absolutely. There's days that we count the hours since the last time in bed, and it was 4 days ago sometimes.
Yeah, wow.
Yeah, so, you know, I have book launches coming up, and I've got Studio 10 in a week, and there's a lot coming up, so I'm always busy and always trying to do it. But I think that's my coping.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, and it's also just you.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, I'm the same. It's just, you know, there's something that some kind of meaning of life in just working.
Yes.
You know, so positively working. So what book's coming up? What are you going on Studio 10 for?
I'm going on Studio 10. I've actually just released a comedy book. So
You're joking. Oh, my God. What is it?
It's called Life, Death and Other Funny Stories. So when I was writing Rope, A History of the Hanged, there was all these odd hangings that are really weird and strange, and I know that now that seems a bit sick, but it's not. There is some amazing funny stories about hangings, you know, where someone started to strangle rather than be hanged, and so the hangman took off on someone's horse and stole the horse, and so then he got pulled back and hanged as well because he was then a horse thief. And there's all these weird and wonderful stories about hangings, and so much so I thought that was a book in itself.
Yeah.
And I thought, well, I can't just do that because that's a bit weird. So I decided to look into other stories, and my passion in life is ancient history.
Great.
And there's a lot of things that happen in ancient Rome and ancient Egypt, and, you know, they have these weird and wonderful rituals and things like that are just absolutely insane. So I'm actually going in.
Oh, wonderful.
This is like a bucket list thing. I'm actually going to almost do a stand-up routine.
Oh, wow.
So about what this book was about.
Oh, great.
About.
Good for you.
It's a bucket list item, but I'm terrified because I'm not funny.
I think you're funny.
I think I'm hilarious.
And you've definitely got the dark sense of humour of a comedian. That's because we've just realised we're both Doug Anthony Allstars fans as teenagers, so that's where we get our dark humour from.
Absolutely.
Wow. So, and I think, I mean, are you prepared for this conversation when people go to you, your husband, when you're writing jokes and you're writing stuff about hanging? And also, I mean, had he read your book?
Oh, he loved this one.
Yeah.
He saw this because he was my yardstick. He was the one who had kept my balance. Because I have looked at child porn, wow. I've seen horrific abuse, I've seen people being murdered, I've seen a lot of that darkness. Mm. And there's some horrifying things out there without even touching the dark web, and I've been there as well, that you can see as part of research. There's been books, I wrote a book called Child Killers.
I know, I'm reading it right now, yeah, I'm halfway through it.
That one I actually stopped for 2 years and threw my laptop across the room and said, no more, it's dark. So my husband was one of those people that says, hun, you've got to come back. Mm. You're going too far into that abyss. And if you go too far, you can't come back. So he was really good at that, and the kids have to learn to do that now too for me. So when I started to put this book together, because I started this one about 18 months ago, because the research for it, every single story in Life, Death and Other Funny Stories is actually referenced. Because some of them you think it can't be true.
Yeah, great.
Well, I found some sources. So, and there's some that is like, well, throughout history, this sort of changed a bit, you know, like Charlie Chaplin coming third in a Charlie Chaplin lookalike. Yeah. And there's urban legends in there too, but I found enough references to say, well, someone said it was actually he came 23rd, and someone said 3rd, and someone said 14th. And so there's a couple of bits and pieces like that, but most of it is actually true stories. And
fabulous.
Some people don't deserve to live because they were that stupid that they died.
Darwinism.
Exactly,
excellent.
Exactly. You know, like the 9 people that went down into a toilet pit, one woman dropped her phone, so her husband went in and died. So the mother-in-law chased him in, had the toilet pit and died because of the methane gas. And, like, 7 other people went in after this bloody phone.
Oh, no.
It's like, yes.
That's like that pit. Did you see that story recently about this temple that they call the Pit of Hell or something or other? Because things die in there and then they realise it's methane gas. It's trapped inside this little
That'll do it.
Yeah, that'll do it. There's usually a really simple explanation. So... where do we start with you? You've chosen to live such a fascinating life. I mean, I've never seen the dark web. I know it exists, but I feel like even if I wanted to look at some really full-on stuff, and I do want to sometimes, like, I'll go and have a look at those live leak videos and stuff like that sometimes. You know, I'm not proud of it, but sometimes I do. And I'm scared of my digital footprint.
Exactly.
I mean, are you scared the FBI is going to come to your house because you've looked at something?
Oh, they have a file on me already, I'm sure. I dip my toes in and I do it with experts.
Okay, right.
Because it's not so much about you going in, it's about who's coming at you.
Yeah.
Because there's a lot of hackers and things like that in the dark web, and I have no idea beyond my free AVG virus program.
Me
how
neither.
To save myself. Nah. So I'm pretty hopeless there. So I do it with the right people that know what to do.
Why do you think it is that you do want to look at that stuff?
Because I need to, like, especially when you're writing about this stuff, you can go clinical, and I have worked in a clinical environment for a long time. But you can think about this clinically, and you can write, you know, and then he raped her and stabbed her and but it is dry and boring, and you can read that in the court transcript. I want to know, because I do a lot of work with serial killers and interviewing them, and I talk to them, and, you know, like Robert Yates, a serial killer in Washington, he goes, oh, you know, if I hadn't left my faith, and he's a Seventh-day Adventist, he goes, there's probably no way I would have killed 18 women and raped them. And it's very dry.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, no. It wasn't just like that. It wasn't click, click, and it's done. It's not like in the films, you know, we can do a half-hour TV show and it's done.
Yeah.
These take a lot of time, and it's about knowing, which unfortunately, when I found my husband's horrifying to know how long it would have taken him to die, and, you know, that goes into my head, which is just...
And you know so much about this stuff,
I know so much, which breaks me probably even more than it would most people that could shut that down. But it's about going into that environment and actually almost standing there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I can read a case and I could be standing there and watching what's happening because I know enough. Because
it's interesting you say that, because I was just reading in your book the John Wayne Gacy story, which I thought I knew. You know, this is a guy who was a businessman, dressed up as a clown, and was raping and murdering young men and burying them under his floorboards. You know, a lot of them. But reading yours, I was like, yeah, like you went into detail about, it felt like almost every victim,
mm-hmm.
really specific about what they were doing before they ran into him, how they ran into him, what the exchange was that got them back to his house, whether it was offering them a ride in the rain or whatever. And then about the process, the magic tricks he used, literally magic tricks to trick them into getting into situations they couldn't get out of. And it really did make me feel like I was there. For the first time, I was suddenly visualizing this house, this whole setup. And I think that's a positive, because I feel, I mean, there'd be other people who go, well, that's sick, why do you need to know all that stuff? But I felt like, no, actually, you know what? You have given me a really clear picture of a story that I
never paid a lot of attention to it, apart from the facts. I go, okay, there's the facts, there's the numbers, there's the guy. He's a weirdo who paints clowns.
Mm-hmm.
But you gave it a lot more depth.
I think because I like to focus on the victims as well. These are real people.
And so you helped me to understand how these real people got into this situation. So I'm not tempted to think they were dumb or they were on drugs or not think about it at all, which we do sometimes with victims. Yeah, you made me really think about how easy it was for these people to end up in this horrible situation.
And that's what a lot of people don't understand, especially with a lot of serial killers. We want them to be monsters, and we use that word, and we call them evil and scary, and, oh, look at his eyes, and, oh, look at the way he looked at that person. Mm. They don't do that. They aren't these boogeymen. They're actually normal people, and they're almost too average sometimes. That's how they get these people.
Well, that's what they say about pedophiles, isn't it? If you looked like a pedophile, no one would let you near their children.
No,
you
have to look
respectable.
Yeah, we expect them to be this, you know, this crinkly old man with a snarl and a skull and a, you know, walking cane and this horrible looking person. And it's not. It's the 27-year-old hot guy. You know, Jeffrey Dahmer.
Yes.
You know, he.
Ted Bundy.
Yeah.
Yeah. What's that Carla Homolka's husband?
Paul Bernardo.
Yes, you're right. It's really handsome young men
mm-hmm.
who we ignorantly go, oh, he could have had any girl. Why does he want to steal girls?
Because he's a psychopath.
Because he's a
monster.
And he wants to hurt people. Yeah.
But they aren't these drooling crazy people that we want them to be. And I think that's why a lot of people like true crime. You know, people often say to me, oh, why do you do that? Mm. And everything's like, do you slow down at a car crash?
Mm.
We all do. We want to make sure that we're okay. It's not about what's happened. It's like, okay, well, you know, I was actually walking down that street. You know, I was outside the World Trade Centers on September 11 and all that sort of stuff. We think, I'm okay. And that's what it's about. It's about the comparison of what's happened to them or that car crash, you know, oh, I'm glad I forgot to make my coffee and went back inside this morning. You know,
you've put a very positive spin on it because I think it's negative. I think that not just in that I feel like I'm looking at it going, oh, God, I'm so vulnerable. We're all so vulnerable. That can happen to us in a heartbeat.
No, we think ourselves lucky.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, so.
Yeah.
And that's what I think, that sometimes we read true crime and we watch things and we have podcasts like this amazing, wonderful podcast that it is, Michelle.
Thank you.
Big fan.
Thank you.
And that's why I'm glad I'm on it. But we listen to these and we try to say, what makes us different? You know, what makes them different to us?
Mm.
And it's sort of because we all have sexual fantasies and things like that. Mm-hmm. We all have that, you know, that kink that we don't share with the rest of the world usually.
Mm-hmm.
But they have that and they use it and they share it at their times that they want to do.
Mm.
You know, we can see that hot guy walking down the street or something. We go, yeah, I can, you know, tie him up and, you know, do whatever, but
I don't want to kill him first.
But that's as far as we go.
Yeah, because that's
serial killer. We go, okay, I want you, and I'm having you. You know?
And also, remember that documentary about Jeffrey Dahmer that he and his father participated in? I'm sure you've seen that. That was an incredible document because they were so honest. And Jeffrey Dahmer talked about the fact that his earliest sexual fantasies, he hadn't been sexually assaulted as a child or anything like that. His earliest sexual fantasies as a teenager involved dead people. And he didn't know why, and that's just how it evolved, and then he made it real.
He would know exactly why. There would be a little catalyst that he would find, whether it was watching Death Wish as a four-year-old or something.
Yeah, right.
There would be something that he might not know consciously, but subconsciously he would know. You know,
something warps the sexuality at some time, do you think?
Something creates an excitement
that
they want to replicate, and that's what it comes down to. So, and I mean, there's lots of different sorts of serial killers. There's baby killers and everything that doesn't have that sexual element. But people like Jeffrey Dahmer and Ted Bundy, they have that element that is about pleasure, you know. We get home on Friday night and we think, yes, we're opening that bottle of wine, you know, and that's exciting. It's
yes, it is.
Love that bottle of wine.
Yeah.
And Tuesday night.
Yeah. Whatever
Every
night.
Every other night of the week.
Whatever night the kids are screaming about the remote control and fighting over something.
Exactly. Well, that's what we think.
Yes.
And they think tonight's the night.
Yeah, it's a blowing off of steam, some people describe it as, isn't it? That it's a build-up of stress and pressure and that's the way to alleviate it.
Because fantasies only exist for so long until it becomes boring again and you have to up the ante. And and that's why a lot of these cases, like Paul Bernardo, actually starts as a rapist.
Yes.
So,
well, actually, and then before that, I mean, we've had, you know, Narelle Fraser, former detective, on this show, who's talked to us a lot about sexual assault and the psychology behind that. A lot of rapists start out as peeping Toms.
Mm-hmm.
And then prior to that, there's a lot of firebugs.
Mm-hmm.
Firebugs generally become sexual predators.
There's a lot of sexual elements with fire. I like fire. I'm a pyro myself. I've never set a fire. I burn a lot of candles.
Yeah, yeah.
But that's my thing. I like candles, and that's as far as but I am on that spectrum that I like candles.
Mm.
With my husband's passing, I actually burn a lot more. But that is a definite segue that happens. And obviously we can go into the torture of animals and everything too. But the excitement of the fire, because that's actually a destruction and obliteration. Mm. And that's often where they end up going with their victims as well. So it becomes a destructive sexual excitement that happens.
Wow. Now, let's talk about Australia's preeminent serial killer, I would have to say, Ivan Milat, because I get accused of name dropping a lot because I drop the Dalai Lama's name into conversation sometimes, but you blew my mind when you dropped Ivan Milat's name into a conversation we were having previously. We won't share what the conversation was about or who it was about, but I mean, tell me how this relationship developed.
Well, it actually started many, many years ago. It was about 25 years ago now. At high school, we had the Granny Killer happen, which sort of like exploded my mind. I was going to be a singer and a dancer, and a lot of people know that story about me. But the Granny Killer actually brought true crime to me. I'd never heard of serial killers and all of that sort of stuff.
So this is the man here in Sydney who murdered elderly ladies. Yes,
and he was a 50-year-old husband and father of two.
Yeah.
And it's actually, you know, and we tried to profile him and said it was going to be a young skateboarder and all of this sort of stuff. And this is around the same time of Silence of the Lambs, which I read about 15 million times, I think, between now and 1988 and all of this. But during all of that, I decided to go to university to do my Bachelor of Social Science in Criminology. And I was reading a book on Ivan Milat. And Ivan actually lives 200 metres from my house or thereabouts. He's very close. Where he was arrested.
Right.
He's like 200 metres from his house.
So not the prison he lives in now.
No.
Right.
No, okay. That's about an hour's drive.
Yeah. Oh, wow.
Yeah. And so I was actually...
So were you living there at the time or where you live now?
Where I live now, which was at the time as well. So yeah, I've always lived here. So
You've always lived in this area and this is the area Ivan was living in. Wow.
So yeah, I can see his house from my back steps. So
blimey.
Yes. And I was at university and reading about the case, and there was factual information in a textbook that I had to pay a lot of, you know, like $150 for, was wrong.
God, that's frustrating, isn't it?
It is, and I'm thinking I'm paying a lot for this degree and they're feeding us the wrong info. And so I decided, well, I know this is wrong. I'm going to ask him.
Wow.
So I wrote to him. And so I've been writing to him for 20-odd years. Yeah, it's about 25 years.
What was his first reaction when he was contacted by a young woman studying who just wants to check out a few facts?
Well, Ivan's innocent, if you ask him.
Yes, I've heard that. Yeah.
So I think if we actually did a lie detector test with him, he'd pass.
Yeah, because he believes that?
Yeah, and that's all it takes.
Yeah. So how did it start, the relationship? You've written him a letter. Did you think he would reply?
I've written to probably 400 or 500 serial killers and killers and murderers and baby killers and pederasts and all that sort of stuff. I've written to lots around the world. I even have a bomber, so from Melbourne, in my list that I've written to over the years that have responded. But it's about, most people write to killers as groupies and, you know, and they're not interested. Killers can spot them a mile off and don't care because they're fans, and they actually find it quite sick.
Really?
Yeah, they think, you know, those that admit to their crimes find it quite sick that these people write to them with adoration. And they're like, you know, you should see the girl who sent me a photo this week in a green bikini, and there's a lot of that happens. Some of them are happy to talk because, let's face it, they don't have much else to do each day.
Yeah.
So Ivan was very much, yes, I'm innocent, I didn't do this. But over the years, I mean, at Christmas time, he sent me 80 pages.
Just Christmas just gone.
Yeah, so just going through, because I am pulling apart the court transcript, because mm-hmm. there's a lot of information in there that didn't that doesn't make sense, and there's a lot of gaps. And doing my master's in criminology now, I want those gaps closed, because there is reasonable doubt in the case that there's more to it. And Ivan will talk in the third person about the Belanglo killer. So, which is quite interesting. That's a whole nother psychology exam just there. But he actually even talked about a moment when he claims in the court transcript that they said, oh, well, he didn't actually kill this victim, someone else must have. And he says to me, so what do they think I was doing, just making a cup of tea while I was watching them rape him? And it's like, well, hang on a sec. No one talks about rape in the case, because there's no proof, because the victims were so decomposed that there's no proof of sexual assault. And here he is talking about what he saw while someone was being raped. And it's like, hang on a sec. But you sort of have to go in easy to say, whoa, you just went there. And you just don't. You sort of have to gently.
You don't call him out on stuff like that?
No, I just ask, so what do you think then did happen then?
Okay.
So, you know, if there was two killers and one standing there watching the other one, well, why were they just standing there watching? You know, and so play out the scenario a bit further, just piece by piece, until you have the whole jigsaw puzzle.
Wow. Which is ongoing. You don't have it yet. It's still...
This is 25 years. So, as I said, there's lots of killers that come and go. I'm talking to Pamela Smart now. I'm going to start name dropping.
Please do. That's what
Pamela
you're here for.
Pamela Smart. There's a movie about her with Nicole Kidman and Joaquin Phoenix called To Die For. It's about this case.
Mm-hmm.
Many years ago I saw it. And so I decided I'd speak to her too, but she's very dull and boring, and she has RSI, so she writes like a one-page thing, you know. We both have a love of dance, so that's what I used to talk to her about, but she's a bit boring.
So what do you do when they're boring? Just stop writing?
Yeah, just stop writing.
Yeah, and go and find another one?
Yeah. So
who's exciting?
Who's exciting? Haddon Clark. Haddon Clark killed two girls, one young girl and one teen 20s girl in the US. He's not mentally stable most of the time, and you can tell when he's got his drugs going well, because he becomes more lucid.
Mm.
But he likes to talk about his time in the Girl Scouts, and he likes to talk about wearing dresses, and all he wants is photos of girls in Girl Scout costumes the whole time.
Wow.
It's all he wants is girls. He's obsessed with Girl Scouts.
Okay.
So, and he sends me colouring pictures that he's done with crayons and of Girl Scouts.
Wow.
And often, because of the US infatuation with Girl Scout cookies, Cookie Monster is often in these pictures as well. He was my favourite Sesame Street character, and that's just ruined it for me, because all these pictures, and I'm thinking, you raped and mutilated these victims, and now you draw pictures of Cookie Monster, and I just can't love Cookie Monster anymore. So it does affect parts of your life sometimes. But
I would think so.
He's
Does it get in your head a bit?
You can't let it.
Yeah.
And that's something I've actually learnt from a lot of these serial killers. They learn to compartmentalise these crimes.
Ah.
So then they can continue with their daily lives. Because as we know now, a lot of them have, you know, spouses and children, and they hold down jobs. You know, this whole profiling thing that they were loners and were of a lower intelligence and all of that, it's gone.
Yeah.
That profile doesn't exist these days.
Yeah.
I mean, that was based on, I think it was 56 serial killers, and they were all white men of that age. I mean, the sample size was poor. But anyway, Mindhunter is still a very good series on Netflix. These killers are actually quite intelligent and everything, so it actually can get to a point that I don't forget. I will never say I forget, because you can't. Because if you let down that guard, they get in.
Mm.
So you can't. So I've actually learned from them how to put that into a box and come back to it. So when it's time to look after the kids, it's time to cook dinner, it's not playing in
and
your
head. And
time
to sleep, most importantly. So
eventually.
does it run around in your mind when you're trying
to
sleep?
No, I've had three nightmares in all this time.
Wow.
So there's three cases that got to me. So there was one of the girl that was thrown off the Westgate Bridge by her father.
Oh, Darcy.
Yeah.
So. Yeah, that was horrible.
It gives me chills even thinking about it, and to imagine her falling and her thought process as a little girl trying to comprehend what's just happened, not knowing what's going to happen. That is stuck in my head forever.
It's unbearable.
Yeah, it just gives me chills. I went to the Anita Cobby crime scene.
Wow.
So it's so close to everything and so far away from everything at the same time. It is such a secluded street. I don't even think it's there now. I think it's a factory complex. You could scream, no one will hear you. And that's exactly what she did. Mm. And no one came to help her. You know, I need to go and see these places. I need to be able to visualize. I need to think about what this looks like at night. I need to think about what it looks like. Where are the people?
Mm.
You know, I've walked Whitechapel for Jack the Ripper and all of that. Mm. Yeah, I like to get that context. I think it makes it real so I don't forget.
It does certainly help you understand a lot of things, mm-hmm. doesn't it? I've done the Jack the Ripper Whitechapel stuff as well. And recently I was in Toowoomba and hearing about a murder. And, yeah, I went and had a look at the crime scene too because I couldn't understand how it could happen so close to town and, it, you know, all that stuff. So, yeah, sometimes you do have to go and just understand the lay of the land around it.
Yeah, because sometimes to dissect it as well, you can actually get into the mind of the criminals that choose these places and how they decide that that's the place to do this.
Yeah.
And I think that that makes it very real, which is why, you know, I need to compartmentalise it because I do go very real. So
the idea that Ivan Milat was living in your neighbourhood, driving out...
I kind of bumped into him at the grocery store.
Driving out of that driveway every day in his high vis to go and do his job and was abducting and killing and potentially raping people.
Mm-hmm.
Amazing.
Right there,
After the break, we get personal with serial killer whisperer Amanda Howard. Coming up on Australian True Crime, Amanda tells us more about the killers she has written to and delves into the quirky, creepy and devious minds she's communicated with over the course of her career.
So who else are your faves, if that's...
Cases that interest me.
Okay.
And serial killers that interest me.
Are there any that you feel friendly about? Are there any that...
No, because...
None that you personally like?
These are horrible, horrible people.
Yeah.
You know, and I never forget that. I mean, I build a rapport with them. Mm. I mean, I get called the serial killer whisperer by some people. It's one of those things. Because I get things out of them because I build that rapport with them. You know, if some people read the letters to and from, it would be horrifying. I've actually had a victim of one serial killer hear a phone call that I had with her killer, with her, well, she was meant to be killed, but she escaped. And I actually had her sit and listen to the tape recording of me talking to him just before he died. And it was the laugh, because he laughed and she said to me, "You're laughing and joking on a telephone call with this person."
Mm.
I said, "Yeah." I said, "This is 15 years of research and talking to this person." I said, "I can't go in there and say, I hate you and you're disgusting and you're revolting. I'm not going to get anything."
No.
I said, "But I need to get information from them. I need to build that rapport with them that I will laugh and joke with them."
Yeah.
But I never forget.
No, I mean, and again, we've had former detectives talk about having to build that bond with really bad
people.
There's
some things you have to say. There's some things that you have to go, yep, I would have done that too. And you think, go and have a shower, you know, and there is that. And I'm glad that people don't read what I write and what they write as well. I mean, that will come out one day, I'm sure. I will write something on all of this. But there's a line I don't cross. You know, I've had proposals and all that sort of stuff as well.
Yeah, do people try and get sexual with you?
Well, I had one killer because I told them all that I had lost my husband because I'm a mess, you know.
Yeah.
It's really tough and it's really hard. And there's times that I think, gee, I have to write to these people and I really have nothing else to say because all I want to talk about is the love of my life.
But that feels like it's making you very vulnerable.
It does. It does.
To them.
And, you know, most of them sent in sympathy cards, you know, just thinking about you, be strong, you know, which regardless of who it's from, you know, that is a nice gesture, you know, to think that these people can do that and that kind of thing. But one of them goes, "Oh, well, if you don't have a husband now, well, I'd like to step in." It's like, "You're a 74-year-old serial killer in Chicago. I really have no interest, you know. Thanks, but no thanks." You know, it's like, really? Really?
Well,
you have to go there?
But it does happen.
It does.
You know, it does happen that women marry these dudes and...
Oh, many.
Yeah.
You see, I don't understand that. That to me is weirder than the serial killer. You know, I don't get that.
I can understand. No, that's really weird. I mean, I feel bad judging people because, you know.
I know.
But anyone that you've tried to write to, I mean, that you've had trouble getting to?
I've tried David Berkowitz a couple of times, the son of Sam Keller. I've tried him a couple of times.
Is he very sick at the moment, I read?
Yes. I did a thing on him on Studio 10 in November or something when he was sick. But we haven't heard anything yet. But With what happened with Charles Manson that we found out so quickly, I think that if David Berkowitz was to die, that we would find out about it quite quickly.
Yes.
So I think Charles Manson was a very big test of what would happen. So with these bigger cases. So I think he must be back in prison because it sort of died down and nothing else happened.
Mm.
But he's one I'd love to talk to. And Dennis Rader, who's the BTK.
Yeah, I was just thinking of him when you were talking about the old-fashioned profile and how this guy, sort of similar to Gacy in that he had a long, successful life, family, working, all that stuff.
Yeah, but can't get to him either. He sends all of his stuff to the lawyer who just sends it all back.
Ah, so not interested.
No.
That's intriguing, isn't it?
But he's only been in prison for a while. They do get bored.
Yeah.
They do need that interaction outside, and that does wear down. So you just keep trying. So as I said, I've written to, you know, hundreds, and I'm more successful than a lot of people are. I get a lot of responses back, but it's nowhere near even 40% I get back. It would be closer to probably 20% that actually respond, and then some of them can be a lot of work. I have a serial killer, Mark Valera, who's in, well, he's not in Supermax now, but he's just down at Goulburn. He killed the mayor of Wollongong.
Yes.
Yeah. He writes to me 6 times a week. That's a lot to keep up on. But especially when he's writing, I ate Cocoa Pops today and I shaved my head and I'm working on my core. When you get 6 letters a week like that.
Yeah.
Like, okay, we'll keep trying. We'll keep talking. And he does talk about a lot of stuff. But at the same time, 6 a week. It's like, why don't you just save them all, put them into one envelope? You know, taxpayers are paying for this. You know, I don't need you to spend $6 a week on postage.
Mm.
You know, just...
Just tell me I ate Cocoa Pops every day.
Yeah.
That's fine.
But, you know, he's quite interesting when he has those days that he opens up and talks a lot. He talks about his family because he had a horrifying childhood. It was just really horrible. And then his sister got her boyfriend to end up killing their father. And so there's a lot of that. And so he talks about that a lot, about the abuse that he endured as a child. And it's just...
And is that your goal? Is that what you're aiming for? Are you aiming to understand these people and to crack them open and get some really personal insights?
I think so, yes. I never had an end game. It was about going to the source and asking the right questions. Of course, asking the right question can take 3 years sometimes.
Yeah.
It really can. It can take a long time to break down. I had one John Robinson say to me, do not ask me about my family, do not ask me about my crimes. His third letter to me included court transcripts and a photo of his family.
Yeah.
You know, sometimes it's easy to break that. I don't play their games. I say to them, you know, when I have the smart come at me, it's like, no. Put it back in your pants, not interested, gross. So kind of thing, you sort of go to that belly girl.
Yeah. Gross.
Yes.
Yeah.
But, you know, I think because I do play a bit of the power game too, I think that they respect that as well. Yeah. That I just don't go, oh, I'm so sorry. It's like, no, that's gross. Don't do that. I'm not interested. This is what I'm interested in talking to you about.
Mm.
So
you have spoken to people who were on death row and who have been... Mm-hmm. Executed?
No, none that are executed because they're really not doing that a lot.
Yeah, right.
But I've had some that have taken their own lives. I have that around me.
Ah.
Yeah.
Wow.
So, yeah, and that's, again, that's hard to reconcile. How do you talk to someone for 15 years and, you know, David Burney in Perth is a perfect example. How do you talk to someone for 15 years? He would ring me twice a week, write to me, Christmas cards, all of that sort of stuff. And then you get to a point that they ring you and depressed, you know, I'm about to go through a big rape case, a prisoner here's blamed me for rape, I didn't do it, you know, if that they won't believe me, they know that he's just one of these people who likes to go through court cases, not fair, I can't do this. And it's like, you know, you'll be fine. Just, you know, this is just something that you're just going to have to deal with. And then he killed himself that night.
Wow.
You know, and I have to sort of, like, I've known this person for 15 years and you can't grieve for them because, you know, that's one less serial killer we have to worry about in this world, and that's a good thing. But at the same time you think, but hang on, I knew this person for 15 years.
Particularly David Burney, is that his name?
Mm-hmm.
He's terrifying. He's the guy and his wife, right?
Mm-hmm.
And they abducted young women,
mm-hmm.
raped them over the course of days.
That's right.
And then the wife started getting jealous that he was having feelings for them or something, and then they started killing them.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he's, yeah, he and photos of them are terrifying, these two.
Oh, I got photos that no one else has.
Like what?
Of him from in prison. What he looked like for the last 20 years of his life. I have most of those photos.
So what sort of bloke is he?
Highly intelligent.
From your experience.
Highly intelligent. Great conversationalist. As psychopathic as a lot of the politicians we have in this country. But he could have been running this country had his life gone that way instead of that way. He was one of those people that you could talk to on any topic and he would know about it and be able to talk.
Mm.
And we would do that often. We would talk about anything and everything. You know, but his biggest thing was he got done for theft early on in his life at about 20. He goes, and had that not happened, I wouldn't have gone this way. That was the moment that his sliding door sort of changed.
Really?
Yeah.
He got done for theft and so he started raping and murdering women?
Well, it wasn't that much of a jump. It sort of then stretched that, you know, he couldn't get another job and so he started to steal things and then, you know, people didn't trust him and so this was his way of getting back, is that he would start beating people and,
wow,
you know, and being a small man.
Yeah.
There's all of that as well.
Yeah. Creepy little small man.
Mm-hmm.
What happened to his wife?
She's still going.
She's still in prison.
Yep. She's in Bandy Up or whatever it's called in Perth.
Do you communicate with her?
No, she's not interested.
Right.
Yeah. So I actually wrote to them both and David wrote back to me and said, she won't speak to you, but I'm happy to talk to you. She doesn't talk to anyone because she was more about her own end game of getting out of prison.
Yeah.
Which,
fair enough,
hasn't happened.
No, no, and I wouldn't think it would, but I can understand that.
Mm-hmm.
Also, it must be, it boils down to that character type, isn't it? There are some of us who like talking about ourselves and some who are happy not to, and we don't understand each other at all. I'm sure she doesn't understand why he would talk to you so mm-hmm. much.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. You she know? Hated it.
Yeah. Myra Hindley and
Ian Brady.
Ian Brady were the same, right?
I spoke to Ian Brady.
You're joking.
No, I spoke to him. He wasn't as smart as they all made out. David
really?
Burney was much smarter than Ian Brady. I was disappointed.
Ian Brady, again, just the most terrifying combination of people mm-hmm. stealing children from the
exactly.
neighbourhood she lived in,
exactly.
children she knew, and murdering them, mm-hmm. taking them away, recording a little girl crying for her mum.
Have you read that transcript?
No.
Okay.
No, I don't want to.
No.
See, that? Yeah, I guess I do have a threshold, because mm-hmm. just hearing you say that then just made me want to
yeah,
curl up.
Her excuse of what they're talking about, because it's very vague.
Right.
And her saying, oh, they asked her to put a gag in her mouth, but if you think it's asking to put something else in her mouth, it makes more sense. But Myra Hindley always said, no, it was talking about a gag. So if you read the transcript, I mean, I went dark and she tried to absolve it a bit, but I think...
But even then, I don't want to know about you trying to put a gag in a small girl's mouth. Mm-hmm. Like, and so how did you speak to Ian Brady after you've gone dark on that? I mean, he is really the worst of the worst, I think, of humanity, this dude.
Yeah, I wanted to go to see, you know, to do a battle of wits. You know, I wanted that Clarice Starling, mm-hmm. Hannibal Lecter moment, and I thought he was my person, and he wasn't. I blitzed him.
You sound disappointed.
I was so disappointed.
Yeah.
I really wanted someone to challenge me, because I've had a few, but I thought that Ian Brady was going to be that top person that, you know, I'm too good for you and, you know.
Yeah.
Fava beans and a Chianti. And I thought we were going to go there. And he was like, oh, yeah, I did read Mein Kampf. I didn't get very far through it. And, you know, I was like, really? I thought, you know, you were reading Dostoevsky and, you know, all
yeah,
of
this.
Yeah,
I thought you were an evil lord of darkness,
exactly,
but no.
He wasn't. And basically he's like, you know, I'm just here until they let me die. They keep force feeding me through the tube and I'm not eating. And really, you're just a wingy old little... you know, it was, it was disappointing.
Do you feel a responsibility to victims' families? Like in that case in particular, there was that one beautiful old lady who was begging and begging to know where her son's remains were. And he would never say. Do you ever feel like, okay, I've got his attention, I should...
Oh, absolutely.
You know?
And, I mean, over the years I've had killers either allude to cases that they're involved in or offer to help with other cases. Like David Burney wanted to help with the Claremont case.
Mm.
So he would give me information and I would pass it on.
Okay.
Happy to do that. Haddon Clark has actually mentioned that there is people in prison for 4 crimes he's done. So that's been passed on. So.
Wow.
Yeah, so.
What a... I mean, tell us about the world that you know prison to be. When you're at this level of incarceration, when you are the worst of the worst, what is their life like? I mean, old mate's eating his, you know, Cocoa Pops and working on his core strength. Is that it? Do they have access to the news? You're saying, you know, David Burney was really smart and could talk about anything. Did he have access to news? Was he keeping up on the news?
It's really different. They all have different access to all different things.
Mm.
David Burney wrote to me on a computer and printer.
Yeah, okay.
He had that. Bobby Joe Long in Florida has this wet noodle pen that he has to write with, that it's a security pen and they only have to have safety paper and all of this sort of stuff. Ivan Milat staples his letters together. Now, he's a known swallower.
He sure is.
So that surprised me when things started turning up with staples. So I don't know if they're stapled later by a guard or something, but it's quite unusual. I thought, oh, this is... Because some of them do imaginative things to stick them together. Mm-hmm. You know, sometimes things are stuck together. I think,
what's that stuck with?
You go there sometimes.
You've got a lot of time to think about how to stick things together, I suppose, in jail. What's Ivan swallowed again? What are we up to?
Oh, we've done razor blades and screws and broken glass.
As a protest?
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay. To get his appeals heard.
Right.
Because the appeals process, because a lot of them talk about their appeals.
Well, again, it seems to me that that's a time killer.
Yeah.
That I've heard that a lot of people in jail have nothing else to do but go to court again and again and again.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, a lot of them do. You know, a lot of them are waiting on the Attorney General and things like that to respond to their appeals. So they do a lot of that. But, you know, some of them send me magazine articles and can we do a Sudoku together through the post and, you know, weird and wonderful things. I have one, Patrick Kearney in California. He every month he sends me his menu for the month that they have, because they eat these weird and wonderful things that we don't have here, and, you know, there's things like biscuits and gravy I still don't quite understand.
Me neither.
I think it's scones.
But yeah, I'm me not- too.
I'm not quite sure. And so he sends me things. And there's things on that. There's something that they eat they call SOS, which is shit on a shingle. I hope I can say that.
Sure.
And it's basically a biscuit and gravy thing, but it's like a dehydrated bread or something. So he goes through and actually writes down what all of these are and how they're made, and this is the kosher menu and this is the Muslim menu. And
That's entertaining.
It is. It's quite interesting. Like, Patrick Kearney is probably one of the smartest serial killers I talk to, and he talks to other killers as well. So he says to me, well, who do you want to know about? And I can tell you about them and introduce you to them as well, and they can talk to you as well. You know, he's spoken to Saran Saran, who killed RFK, you know, and he actually was friends with Lee Harvey Oswald before he went to prison. And
so what do you do then? You get that list of names, you Google? Like, do you?
Oh, no, I know them. So especially because, you know, I often say that cases that I'm interested in is like JFK. Like, the JFK conspiracy is one of my favourite things of all time. I spend a lot of time researching it. To have a killer go, well, actually, I was with Lee Harvey Oswald when he was going to Mexico, and then we have this great big redacted files come out with all this stuff about Lee Harvey Oswald going to Mexico the next week. It's like, hang on a sec, I've got information on this now.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of that happens. You know, I do let them in on things that I'm interested in, because often that sort of opens up some dialogues as well. But yeah, so some killers I've met through other killers. And
yeah, so how does that process normally happen? Do you have a list of people?
Oh yeah, I've got a big list.
Yeah, that you're working your way through. When there's a new serial killer discovered,
I think about them and I look into them and wait to see how the cases are going. Like, Piers Morgan's actually just doing a big thing on Lorenzo Gilyard. Well, I've been talking to him for 2 years.
Well, who's he now?
He's a black serial killer in the US.
Right.
So he's very religious. So I don't know how he would come across on TV. I don't think that's going to be as exciting as people think, because I find him actually quite subdued and quiet. So that'll be interesting to see. You know, people often send me recommendations. Like, someone sent me a recommendation the other day, Confessions of a Serial Killer or something on Netflix or something.
Mm.
And it's about Arthur Shawcross. It's like, well, Arthur Shawcross wanted to be my father, you know. I know him personally, so I don't need to actually watch that. Arthur Shawcross killed 2 young children when he was in his 20s, went to prison for about 15 years, come out and killed about 20 prostitutes in America. I can't think of the state. I think it's New York.
Right.
Yes, in New York. So he actually wrote a recipe where I was one of the ingredients. He sends me artwork. Yes, your face.
As in, I want to cut you up and put you in a pie?
I want to cut you up and put you in a jambalaya.
Jambalaya. That's another thing I don't understand. We'll have to ask.
That's a spicy curry.
Okay, cool. So Mr. Biscuits and Gravy,
yeah,
we'll have to.
Yeah, yeah. A jambalaya is a, yeah, lots of veggies, lots of fragrant spices. And
lots of you.
Because you're reading ingredients and you go, because I talk to a lot of Kellers about food. I mean, when you don't get to this size without speaking and eating.
But it's also one of the great pleasures that we have in common. Yeah. So, yeah.
And even in prisons, I mean, some of them get really good menus.
Okay.
So I do talk about them. And I often open up with these Kellers asking them, like, if you had to pick one meal for the rest of your life. Now, what I'm actually asking is, what's your last meal?
Yeah.
But that's not how I ask it. I say, if you had to eat one meal for the rest of your life. See, so you word things differently. You know, yeah. It's not like, gee, you're on death row and you have to pick something soon.
No, you're wording it the cute way.
I'm wording it in an interesting way to open a dialogue. Yeah. You know, and some of them, like Haddon Clark, steak tartare and snapping turtle and weird and unusual things like this. Like me, it's chicken schnitzel and gravy.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. I'm not that exciting. But some of them actually are quite interesting and they go through this whole menu and you think, yeah, you've thought about this. You're going to have to pick this soon. I mean, some states don't do it now.
They don't do the last meal thing.
No, because there was one guy in, I'm going to say Texas, but I could be wrong, who ordered like 9 pizzas, 4 tubs of chicken and all of that and then said, no, I don't want it. And it was like $400 worth of food that they said, well, guess what, guys, you're not getting it. And let's face it. The victims didn't get a last meal.
No, of course not. And that's also, what
I think it's a, you know, I know these people have been in prison and they've built rapport with their, you know, their guards and all of that.
Yeah.
But I think that that's a privilege that they don't deserve.
No, it is a weird thing, isn't it? And it's wide open for shit stirring, such as I'll have 14 pizzas and...
Yeah.
Okay, I can understand that. Wow.
You know, I mean, we can romanticise it like in that Stephen King film, Green Mile.
Oh, the Green Mile,
you know, and it's like... You know, we want these people to have that final meal, but it's not like that. These people are going to hell, basically. They don't get to have...
Well, that movie's a really good example, actually, of how we can't help but assume everyone's really good. Mm-hmm. Somewhere deep inside, everyone's actually good, even if they do terrible things. And that's what that movie's all about, isn't it? The one really, truly bad character is a guard.
And the books are even, he's even worse.
Is he? So, yeah, right. Yeah. Okay. So that's not your experience then?
No. No. These people, I mean, what they go through, it's actually, I've had a lot of killers say to me, it's between 7 and 15 years. After that, it's just another day. You are institutionalised. This is normal. This becomes your life and you forget what the world is outside. And let's face it, just think how it's changed in just that long.
Oh, I can't imagine.
And some of these, you know...
I know some prisoners in the States have never seen the internet, right?
Yeah. Well...
Yeah.
Bobby Joe Long in Florida, he's been in since 86.
And he's not one of these guys who has a computer
in his cell. No, he has a wet noodle pen.
Yeah.
So he doesn't, like... To come out now, it's just, I think, well, as a Stephen King film, again, Shawshank Redemption, you know, everything's going so fast. And everything these days does. I mean, out there, just imagine coming back basically out of a time capsule. It would be insane to come back to. But he's one example. He's on death row. He thought he'd never be executed, and Florida hasn't done many executions for about 15, 20 years, I think. And then his last letter he sent to me, which was just before Christmas or just after, said one of his cell block mates was executed. He goes, so, whoa, now it's real again.
It's back on.
It's back on. And his letter was very, very different. He's usually full of bravado and talking about that he was a sun god back in the day because he could tan and, you know, he loved being on the Everglades and getting, you know, have this Dexter image in your head. But, yeah, he's like, whoa, hang on a sec. I've been sort of not caring because it wasn't happening and now it's happening again. So
that's what sort of surprised me about David Burney killing himself the way you were talking about it before, the Perth guy, because I would think he's in jail for the rest of his life anyway. So if another inmate accuses him of rape and he hasn't really done it but he's got to go through the courts, what does that actually mean to your day-to-day life? Like, why would you care? I don't know what I'm talking about, obviously,
No, absolutely. He just saw it as he'd built up trust and rapport and he was just doing his daily life and that's what he believed. It wasn't just that. He'd been told that he could no longer speak to me.
Right, okay.
Catherine had also stopped contact because she was trying to do her parole process and there was a thing with his meds as well. But this was just the final straw saying... because I'd been talking to him about it for weeks and weeks. But then he'd got to a point that they said, yeah, we're going ahead with this. You're right. Being charged. This is going to add to your sentence. This is bad points. You know, this is not good. Okay. You go into segregation. You lose your computer.
Right.
You know, everything's stopping. I was being stopped, you know.
Well, now it makes sense to me.
Yeah, so it's a lot.
I imagine you have very little. And then when they talk about taking that.
Yeah, yeah. Actually, in that last telephone call, they actually talk about tossing your cell and taking everything away. And he's like, you know. He says, I wouldn't care if I did it, but I didn't do it, you know. I mean, it could be total bullshit, and I get that.
Mm-hmm.
I tell them a lot of lies too, you know. They don't know my whole story.
No.
And you don't. You can't. But there is things I do share just to keep that going. But, you know, you sort of think that happened, and I get a phone call from a prisoner in the same cell block that says, you know, I'm ringing to let you know before you find out that David took his life. So...
Wow.
So, and I'm like, okay, what do you do with that? You know, goodbye, good luck, don't care, do care, waste of my time. You know, I don't know, you know, and it's still, I mean, that's been 10 years or 15 years now. It's still something I don't know how to reconcile. That was a 15-year period of my life that I spent, and I don't know what to do with that.
Yeah, how weird.
It is.
Are all of these contacts, these relationships that you've built, are they all for work? Like, do you use them all in your work somehow? You write about them or in your study?
Yeah, it's part and parcel of what I do. I'm working on some TV stuff around it as well.
But I guess you're also building an overall knowledge base,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, because I'm not just doing, you know, our white male serial killers. You know, yeah. I've got females, I've got a bomber, as I said. When you get a big parcel from them, you do kind of think, oh.
Yeah.
Really? You're the only one who sends me parcels. You know, why? But I know that, you know, it goes through a lot of screening before it gets to me.
Yeah. But what's in them?
Letters and bits and pieces and court transcripts, okay. But it's just chunky enough. You think the bomber sends me parcels.
Yeah,
you know, I've as I said, I've got a spousal killer. I've got Teresa Knorr, who killed her two daughters in the most brutal way over many, many years of abuse. She's a piece of work, and she's probably one of the nastiest. Now, Teresa Knorr, actually, she's had about five husbands. She killed one of her husbands in self-defense. Mm-hmm. She, I used air quotes there.
Yes,
you can't see. You can't see those on a microphone.
I think we sort of heard them in your voice, though. Yeah.
And, yeah, so when I actually told her that I had lost my husband, her response was, yeah, well, I killed one of mine. You know, it's like, okay.
Okay.
I'm the same kind of grief.
You can kind of relate to me, I guess. Yeah.
Wow. But she killed two of her daughters. Now, one of them had said, Mum, I want to move out of home. And now this is after years of physical and emotional abuse.
Is this in Australia?
No, in the US. Wow. Sorry, I just know that people
should
know
what I'm talking about. Yeah, that's right.
I forget. There's so much in here in my head. She killed her eldest daughter by shooting her in the back when she asked to move out of home. And she would force feed her girls and would blame them for sexual abuse and diseases and all this horrible, horrible stuff. And then now she had sons as well who she doted on, but the girl she hated, saying, you know, wow. I think it was like a competition and jealousy thing.
Mm.
So her eldest daughter wanted to leave home, so she shot her in the back. And the bullet stayed in her spine, and she wasn't well, but she continued her life for a bit longer. And then she said, well, fine, I am going to leave. This is months later. And so her mum says, yeah, well, you can leave, but I'm taking the bullet out first. So got her drunk and drugged her and put her into the bathtub and got out a box cutter, decided to go into her spine to get out the bullet.
But before you go on, sorry.
There's a lot more.
I know, I'm guessing that. Yeah. How were they still living together after her mum shot her in the back? Why did the police, why was she not in jail?
Nothing.
Why
no,
was?
No, just...
Business as usual.
Business as usual. I mean, we're talking 80s, so it's not like it's even like the 1950s where things were a bit more secretive. I don't know. But
maybe they said it was an accident or something?
Yeah, for almost 12 months this girl had a bullet in her spine.
Oh my God.
So when she got her drunk and tried to take it out, she got it out almost successfully. The daughter got sepsis, so, and got very, very sick. And almost died. So when she thought she was dead, she got her sons to put her into the car. They took her out to a secluded area and set her on fire. She died of burns. So that's not a good way to go. Then her second daughter, about 12 months later, she decided she was getting too cocky for her ways as well and locked her in a cupboard for a week until she stopped. So in like 50 degree heat.
Until she stopped banging.
Until she stopped, yeah. Yeah, died of... Yeah, so she left after the banging, obviously, several more days.
And you communicate with this lady?
And I communicate with her, and she's one of the ones that... She's horrifying. She blames her youngest daughter. She had three girls and two boys. She blames the youngest daughter, who was like 12 at the time of these killings.
But she says she physically conducted the killings?
Yes, was to blame, that she had done it and not the mum. So, and then once the second daughter was dead, they packed her into a cardboard box and dumped her and set the house on fire. And that's how she got caught, was arson, because then the youngest daughter spoke and told police what she'd seen.
My God.
This is all in my head.
Yeah. This is in your mailbox, mate. Forget your head. This is physically in your world.
I wonder what the post office sees when they go, oh, Ivan Millar.
Is that written on the back of an envelope?
Does it say written on the front. Yeah, Charles Manson, you know.
I Millar, Silverwater Prison, whatever it is.
Supermax,
that's the address of the sender.
Yep.
It would be very exciting, I reckon, to be your postie. Ooh, what's she got today? That's amazing. What's next? What's the future for you, do you think? Not you personally. I understand that that's a really difficult question right now. But for your work, so you're studying, is that right?
Yes, I'm doing my Masters of Criminology and Criminal Justice.
I mean, that to me and a lot of our listeners would sound hella cool that you're doing that. To have a Masters in Criminology is really cool.
It's something I was supposed to start last year, but obviously it went on hold.
I'm so glad you got back to it.
Well, I was doing another master's in writing last year, so I had 5 weeks to go when my husband passed away, and because I'd done my big final assignment, I knew I said the last 5 weeks were pretty easy because I'd done that.
So you managed to complete that?
I managed to complete that, so I got a master's in writing.
That's incredible.
So now I'm doing my Masters of Criminology, and I've got arson coming up, which I'm very interested in doing.
What do you mean?
I just
is that a unit, arson?
Yes, yeah,
right, okay.
Yeah. So I'm very interested to see about that sexual element and everything of a fire setting, because it is fascinating.
Isn't it? I had no idea until Narelle told us.
Yeah. Oh. So it's just one of those topics that I was keen to see, and I've got others. There is white collar crime and all of that. It's like, no, arson.
Sure, yeah.
That's the one. I mean, this week we did road rage, so I had to write an article on road rage.
What a week as well, when that man in Sydney was sentenced, right, a week ago for the road rage, manslaughter, where he pushed the man. They were by the side of the road and he shoved him.
Oh, I missed that.
And he fell under a bloody garbage truck, I believe.
Oh, okay.
So, yeah.
Oh, okay. No, I was
you would have had your head in a book. Yeah.
I probably did this week, doing lectures online.
Yeah. Wow. So, well, you're very inspiring to me. I love the depth and the level that you go to, and the fact that you're studying and, pushing your education is so exciting.
Well, I always think that there's more, and...
Oh, well, this is it. You'll never run out of stories.
No, I mean, I'm probably in the worst country to be a serial killer expert, for want of a better term.
Sorry about it.
I know. It's bad for business here, which is a good thing. It means our police are doing the right thing. We're catching them earlier, or we don't have them.
Yeah.
There is a couple of hot spots around the country I do watch.
Do you think there are serial killers going on? Because this is always the story we hear, is that at any one time there are something crazy like 25 serial killers working in the States.
500.
No! Really?
Yeah. I do watch a lot of cases, and there's some hot spots. There's a couple of what we believe are going to be truckers along the highways picking up prostitutes and dumping them at the next stop.
In the States?
Yeah. There's a lot of those. But here, there's one out west in New South Wales that I'm watching. Been quiet for a couple of years now. So Adelaide's just a massive hotspot for all crime, so which is why I spend some time there. I have a rapport with the people in Adelaide, and they let me in, and I'm working on a couple of cases, as I said earlier.
It sounds like a sort of dark joke that the serial killer expert would spend a bit of time in Adelaide, because it does have this reputation of weird murder capital.
But it's warranted.
Right.
It's warranted.
Yeah.
If you want the weird and wonderful.
Well, certainly when I read about the Snowtown murders, what I found most terrifying was the description of the places these people grew up, the suburbs in Adelaide, the endemic unemployment, sexual abuse, drug abuse, alcohol abuse. I mean, sad, just so sad, but also terrifying. It made me think, oh, maybe that's why.
No, I don't think so.
You don't?
No, I mean, that, yes, there's the smaller crimes of the theft and all of that that happens, but I don't think that breeds serial killers. I think serial killers...
You don't think John Bunting was bred by that environment?
No, he was going to do that regardless.
Okay.
If he lived on the North Shore of Sydney.
Really?
Well, let's face it, John Wayne Glover lived on the North Shore of Sydney.
The granny killer,
Yeah, so, I mean...
Have you written to Bunting and those guys?
No, but I was on Studio 10 about this time last year, and I was talking about the Snowtown case because we did a special in 1999, and that's when that all exploded.
Mm.
And I actually, instead of saying Mark Hayden and James Vlasakis, I actually said Mark Vlasakis, so I combined two names.
Yes.
John Bunting come at me.
Did he really? What do you mean?
He wrote to me and said, because someone knew me from, because I talked to other people
around the tracks
at Yatala prison.
Yeah.
He actually wrote to me and like, you know, WTF, you don't know your stuff. I just wrote back, you know, it's live TV, shit happens.
Totally.
I got to, you know, out of five names, I mixed up two, because, and you can see me on screen going, something just went wrong.
Yeah.
I just don't know what it was.
Yeah. I do that all the time, but I don't expect John Bunting to write me a letter about it. My God.
So they watch.
Wow.
That's weird.
Yeah. Have you told Ita? I mean, she'll want to know they're watching.
No.
I'm doing it on Tuesday. I have to tell them. My God. Serial killers are watching you guys.
Yeah. So I do have to. I do get a lot of hate after I do... my TV spots, but I mean, it's part and parcel and it's going to happen forever and I'll get...
From the subjects or...?
No, from all sorts of walks of life. How dare you? This is sick.
Yeah.
You know, you get all of that. A lot of people write to me and say, oh, can you look at my case?
Of course.
You know, and that as well. I did a big thing on the Adelaide kids the other day, as well as William Tyrrell and a few other... I was talking about these cases that have million-dollar rewards and does it help?
Yeah.
And, some Adelaide people come at me saying, how dare you talk about this case? And it's like, well...
Yeah, because most generally unsolved crimes, the victims' families desperately want to keep in the media.
Yeah, it was quite odd. And as I said, I'll get more forever, you know. And I've had people go at some of my friends too, saying, like, how dare she talk about this case? And it's like, William Tyrrell's family okay, you know,
yeah. Surely anything to keep.
All of the others,
story.
I just, you know, these are 40-year-old cases. We have nothing to go on.
Mm.
Someone might think that, you know, oh, I spoke to the police at the time. They never got back to me. It obviously wasn't anything. But it's not. It's often that piece of paper fell over, got chucked in the bin.
Yeah.
And they don't know. They need you to call again. And that's what I was talking about.
Isn't like, that frustrating? Dare? Yeah. When people phone with information and it just gets kind of lost in the shuffle.
It happens way too often.
A lot.
It's terrifying.
Yeah. You think, well, I rang them. It mustn't be anything.
Exactly. And that's what I went on to talk about, because the Beaumonts had been in the press with the big dig that had happened, which I knew was going to be wrong. Still watched it. But, you know, it's just, I was quite surprised by some of the responses I got.
What about victims' families? Do you ever get any of them saying it's sick that you write to this dude or that you're interested in serial killers? It's weird.
I get both. So some are like, thank you because I've said something and that helped them.
Yep.
Some of them say, you know, it's happened, they're dead, let it go. Mm. And it's like, well, I don't know, it's what I do. You know, sometimes I hate myself for what I do.
So do I.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of our listeners do too. It's a common, I think we all have this, like it's a...
It's guilty. A moral compass.
Yeah, definitely.
Well, we know that, like, we're not loving this. We're fascinated and that's different.
Well, I even had the brother of a murder victim, and again, this was from a historic case, and I knew that he had spent his life, it obviously just ruined his life and all that. And he said to me on the phone, he was very lovely, didn't want to be interviewed, but we had a lovely chat. And he goes, yeah, I know about you and I know that you're fascinated with murder. And I thought, oh, I felt so bad, so guilty. Yeah. And I said, oh, look, I said, honestly, I'm really fascinated with how people cope, you know? Like, I don't know if that's any better, but I said to him, I'm really, like, I'm fascinated with how... with your life and how you've lived beyond this and how you've coped and how you've, you know, and I think that's genuinely what we're into. Certainly Emily and I are into, you know, the victims' families and what happens next. Mm-hmm. That's our big thing. Okay. Yeah. So murder happens. It's in the paper. you feel sorry for the person and then you forget about it. But what actually happens next, you
absolutely.
Know?
Absolutely.
But it is a very uncomfortable feeling when this man goes, yeah, yeah, look, I know. And it wasn't having to go at me.
No.
He was just saying, yeah, I know about your podcast. I know you're really into murder. I thought, oh.
Yeah.
This happened to your sister. You know.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's true. And that's true. And that's why a lot of us actually speak out and say, this is what I do. It's not what I am. It's not gratuitous. It's not a thrill-seeking thing.
No.
It's part and parcel of this journey of life. I mean, we have a very bloody history in this country. I mean, with the white settlers coming and everything and the horrifying things that happened then, I mean, this is something that's always been, you know, and it's not something that we're going to solve. And crime is a reaction to society. And there is a reason that the US has more serial killers 100-fold to everywhere else. There's a reason for that.
Right? There has to be.
There is a reason. There is a reason that we don't.
There has to be a reason why, yes, certain crimes are prevalent in certain cultures. And that's worth looking at and asking the question.
And that's why I do. And that's why I talk to people. You know, granted, I'm speaking to most of the first world, you know.
But yeah, but no.
Purely because of language.
Yeah.
You know, I do have a killer that would happily translate every letter I get because he speaks about 7 languages, but I'm not doing that.
Mm.
You know, so I do speak to more sort of white Anglo-Saxons, but I do have, you know, some black killers and I have females. And because, but it's, you know, why does it happen? And why is there a pocket in Florida and Texas? You know, these places that have the death penalty have more serial killers. So,
how fascinating. So then how can we argue that it's a deterrent?
That's not.
You see, these
have been a deterrent.
These are the kinds of stats that people like you, through, you know, the hardship of going deep on these cases, figure out, and that's actually really important, isn't it?
Absolutely.
In terms of legislation and...
I mean, we used to hang people for stealing bread.
Yeah.
Like, literally, I know that that's... But that is true. There is a case in my book called Rope about 2 children that were hanged. One was 8 and one was 10 or 10 and 12 or something like that, that were hanged together for stealing bread. Like, they're starving.
Yeah.
You know, so executions have been something that it's almost been diluted.
Yeah.
You know, that... It's only a deterrent for the worst of the worst, and a lot of these people don't expect to be caught, or if they do, they expect it. But they also know that Bobby Geelong's been on death row since 1986. You know, do the math, however long that is, 30-something years. I have no idea.
Just do the math yourself. Yep.
Yeah, do your math. Yep. You know, like, that's not a deterrent.
No.
He's getting 3 squares. There is people out there starving,
and
he's getting treated better. So...
Well, I think your work's
not.
No, I think your work's really valuable, and not just to us, to we true crime fans, but there's a really classic case of you sort of bearing the burden of all of this information, but there is it's necessary. There's a purpose, there's a point to it, even beyond great books and all that kind of stuff.
Thank you.
If you'd like to get your hands on Amanda's books, check out our Facebook page for details. That's Australian True Crime on Facebook.
Thank you for downloading Australian True Crime, and thank you to our team, which is one person, Bartholomew Heeran. If you enjoy the podcast, please take the time to leave us a nice review and 5 stars, and to follow us on Facebook.